On this week's 51%, we hear from an author devoted to raising awareness about ocean conservation and climate change.
I had no idea what a grave crisis we're facing with the state of the ocean, but also the state of our planet.
Then a girls' basketball team gets a clothing makeover, and the game gets easier. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
It's the L-O-V-E, the O-C-E-A-N.
Love the ocean.
You got a S-A-V-E, the O-C-E-A-N.
Save the ocean.
Make a C-O-M-M-O-T-I-O-N.
Make a commotion.
To S-A-V-E, the O-C-E-A-N.
Two-thirds of the world is covered with ocean, and human pollution makes a big commotion. Cause every single living thing pays the price. When global warming melts, the ocean's ice. Burning fossil fuels.
As heavy hitters held high-profile talks at the UN Climate Conference this month, one woman continued her call to action. After Liz Cunningham had a near-death accident in the ocean in which she was temporarily paralyzed, she was left with a sense of despair and alienation from the waters to which she had always turned for solace and healing. As she recovered physically, Cunningham vowed that she would reconnect with the ocean and recover hope, hope for herself and for the planet's ailing waters. In her book Ocean Country, One Woman's Voyage from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas, Cunningham shares her two-year global journey to discover how communities and individuals are fighting to save the marine world and creating hope through action.
Well, I go back 19 years, and I was in a whitewater kayak accident, and I was almost killed in that accident. And then during the process of healing up for it, I was in a really unusual position because I'd always loved the ocean, but now it really terrified me. And so that aroused, over a period of time, a really deep curiosity about the ocean. And I originally had covered presidential politics as a journalist. And over about a decade of healing, I decided, why don't I get started and start writing about the ocean? And that led ultimately to writing this book.
And where was the accident?
The accident was in Northern California. I've been asked a number of times where it was, and I quite frankly want to keep that private because I don't want the place to be stained by it. There are rogue waves everywhere in California and, you know, many ocean places. The one thing you do, you know, if you're on the beach or, you know, you're out in a kayak, it's very good to keep an eye on the horizon because certainly I was riding a wave in and then suddenly I felt the stern of my kayak lift and I looked back and I was like, oh my God. So, you know, it came up quite by surprise.
But now you take this and instead of saying, I'm not putting my toe in water ever again, you know, after you finished your long recovery, you say, I'm going to use this in a different way. And so you say, okay, I'm going to go learn more about the ocean. So what do you do?
Well, you know, I want to preface by saying that I'm not so courageous as to just brush my fears aside and decide to do that. I was really scared of the water. I remember going back near the site and I put one toe in the ocean and I just felt this ripple run up my spine. So there was quite a process of learning to get back in the water and be in the water without fear being dominant. After I finished the book, one thing, you know, after you finish a book, you start to reflect in a new way. And one thing has really struck me from the whole process of writing this book. And that is how fear and courage can really coexist. And the courage just needs to stay a little bit ahead.
As you were learning about the ocean, and as you said, kind of living with this marriage of fear and courage, what are you learning and what do you suddenly see? Now this gets to be kind of an activist cause.
Yeah, well, what happened is, you know, I set out to learn more about the ocean. I realized through the accident and healing up how deeply I'd always loved the ocean. Because I felt compelled to get back in the water and get over my fear. And I realized, wow, you know, this had always been a happy hobby. Now I realize I adore the ocean. So my thought was, let's take my skills as a journalist and marry them to writing about ocean conservation. I was just blissfully moving along, you know, going, wow, this is going to be incredible. I'm going to learn so much. I'm going to enjoy it so much. And what happened was I had no idea what a grave crisis we're facing with the state of the ocean, but also the state of our planet.
There are a couple of different, more than a couple of different grave concerns, but what do you think ranks the highest here?
At this point, climate change, I think that it is tremendously grave. Right now, we need decisive global action on climate change. This cannot be overstated. And a lot of the communication about climate change right now has been around future scenarios. If we keep doing X and Y, we're going to get Z in 30 years or 50 years. But one of the things that I witnessed myself is a lot of these horrendous effects are already happening now. For instance, when I was in the Turks and Caicos Islands in 2012, within a week's time, I saw a coral reef that was absolutely teeming with life. It was so beautiful, become like a barren moonscape because of coral bleaching. And right now, it's being reported that we're having a global mass coral bleaching underway that could result in damaging 4,500 square miles of devastated coral. And that's the size of the state of Connecticut. That's happening now. So 25% of all marine life depend upon a healthy coral reef. Over 850 million coastal people around the world, they depend on fish, either as a primary food source or on employment in the seafood industry. And one of the things that's happening, and one of the things that makes this more invisible, is that the poorest of communities in the world, those are the ones that are being hit hardest and fastest. So we're not seeing it in the media as much as we should. But one of the things about this was, I went out, discovered this terrible thing that's happening, but what I also discovered that I also don't feel is being reported is that there are millions and millions of people working on this problem. They need our help and they need our support. And that is a very, very positive thing that's happening. And that movement is growing rapidly.
How do you get other people interested in this who aren't already?
I think through telling my story of discovery, because what happened for me is that I went out and I started traveling and I started meeting with scientists and they started showing me things. And my reaction to this was, hey, I read the New York Times. I keep up on things. And I was completely aghast. I was like, how come I didn't know this? That life as we know it right now on this planet is not possible 100 years from now unless we make dramatic changes. That the quality of our water and the quality of our air is degrading so fast, and this is going to affect food security. And if food security is affected, there is a much higher possibility of more violent conflict. And you see the dominoes, and you go, wow, unbelievable. And you would think you'd want that on the front page every day, lowering the carbon imprint, doing things for the ocean. So somehow it's becoming an issue, but it still needs to work its way up on the list of priorities. It has to be a call to action. And I think the level of a call to action, which people are beginning to voice, and that's one thing I'm very happy to see, is that this level of call to action needs to engage all of us the way World War II did. Every household, every person, every school, we're all going to need to pitch in to make this work. But the one thing about that is that we're really capable of it. We have that capacity. And very often, these kinds of efforts, just like World War II, they bring out the best in us and they bring us together as communities. This is not necessarily some grim, horrible thing to have to do.
Is the state of the ocean now, if we don't take positive action in a grand way, or even on a smaller scale, however you want to phrase it, can we get back to a certain level of health of the ocean, or are we at a point where we're now just trying to not keep it from degrading further?
Yeah, I think that's very important. And I feel that that relates to one of the things about ocean country that is unique. And that is that I experienced both in the kayak accident and also in the stories that I heard of activists around the world. In both of these, I experienced people, myself and other people, getting to a place where they really thought perhaps they had passed the point of no return, but they didn't quit, and they actually were able to turn things around. And I think that this is terribly important in our body politic at this moment in history to address that sensation and that thought and realize that even if we can't see how we can turn things around, not to quit. Start putting the scenarios together for the future that we think will work and roll up our sleeves and get going. in terms of the ocean, industrial fishing has to be addressed. We have to end overfishing. We have to start looking at the pesticides and sewage that's going in the ocean, and we have to get our carbon imprint down. Those are three of many priorities. I mean, other ones are reducing the amount of plastic that goes into the ocean, finding ways to get it out of there, and also increasing marine protected areas. What I experienced over 2 years of travel were some of the most beautiful and brilliant people I'd ever met in my life, working doggedly, refusing to accept the idea that you can't turn this around, and already creating small turnarounds, already making progress.
You know, maybe you have a story or two from your travels of encountering when you said someone so doggedly would not give up the fight or something. Maybe you could talk about what happened in a certain village or city or whatever the case is, where there's an example of something so heartening.
Well, I have two of them. One really changed my personal attitude, and one really applies to the larger global threat that we have down the road. The first one is that one of the most courageous people that I met in my travels was in Sulawesi, and it was a former dynamite fisherman, and he agreed to talk to me anonymously. And he described how bombs had accidentally gone off and maimed his friends. One friend lost an eye, one became blind in one eye, and you could literally see the horror of this burning in his eyes. And he explained how dynamite fish are shipped to Hong Kong, through the black market, how it ran through organized crime networks. It also ran narcotics. And so this guy explained to me, though, that if you worked as a dynamite fisherman, you could make $85 to $170 a day. But if you used sustainable methods, you might only make $5, or maybe, if you're lucky, $40 a day. But this guy had gotten to a place where he couldn't stand it anymore. He also saw that his kids would have no fish left to eat because the coral reefs were being so decimated. And the dignity of this man, he had such an arresting and kind of dignified courage, and he was doing so much with so little. He became part of a collective of fishermen, and that collective, they all agreed collectively to stop dynamite fishing. And there were a series of these collectives in the southeastern section of Sulawesi, and they all organized to do this. And in a 10-year period, there was a 70% reduction in dynamite fishing. And it made me feel like if they can do so much and do with so much less money for the benefit of the ocean and the benefit of their children, it made me feel like, wow, what can I do with the resources I have? So it really shook me out of that, what I call now a false sense of helplessness.
It sounds obvious by the title, but what is dynamite fishing?
What it is you're on a boat and you wrap up some dynamite. Sometimes they use pesticides and a Coke bottle as well, all kinds of concoctions. And one person goes to the bow of the boat and you light the fuse. And you have to throw it so the timing is just right. It has to blow before it hits the water because otherwise it won't go off. But if it blows up too soon, it's going to blow up in your hand. So it's just extremely dangerous. And very often, there are organized crime bosses that hire people cheaply to do this, so their arms won't get blown off. But there are also locals who dynamite fish. And I was in Sulawesi in August, and I was underwater, and I could hear it happening. And you could feel it in your ears, and it was like a bomb had gone off.
But how does this get the fish? How does this work?
What this does is this actually ruptures the swim bladders of the fish. And then the fishermen go down and they just scoop up all the fish. And the reef has been completely decimated, flattened like a landing strip. And all it is little tiny stubby pieces of dead coral that are like gravel.
And your other story?
The other story is a much more of a macro story. And I sought this out because I felt that I think one of the things that I learned and wrote about is that one of the most pernicious wolves in sheep's clothing is pessimism disguised as pragmatism. That people go, okay, this conservation stuff, you know, it's really nice, but it's not pragmatic. You know, it's really not the way the world works. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And so I wanted to seek out a success or a change that was done in a very hopeless context. And I found it. And what it was I studied the Atlantic bluefin tuna fishery. And this fishery was considered perhaps the most hopeless fishery in the world. Several years ago, the stocks were just plummeting to extinction. In some parts of the world, they were down to 1 or 2% of pre-industrial levels. And if you look at this fishery, bluefin tuna is hunted for sushi and sashimi. If you look at this fishery, one bluefin can fetch over $500,000 at the market. The fishery is tough to manage because these fish, they swim through international waters. The fish are hunted with these huge freezer boats that use high-tech harpoons and sonar and spotter helicopters. The black market was big. Even the mafia was on it. And even despite this, all over the world, you had people working to save bluefin from extinction. Petitions, social media campaigns, position papers, documentaries, all this stuff. You know, chefs stopped serving it in their restaurants. But the stocks kept going down. And then in 2012, all of a sudden, the stocks stopped plummeting and came up a bit. And I asked Sergey Tudela, who's one of the world's foremost experts on bluefin, and I said, what happened? How did this happen? And he said, we didn't quit. And he added that no matter what happens to bluefin, this shows that joint efforts can save even the most hopeless fishery in the world. And what was happening is all around the world, people were quitting, but they couldn't see if it was going to be enough, it was going to add up, but they were dogged about it. And I think it's a really important example because it's international in scope, and it was very wrapped up with big money and organized crime. And, you know, we don't know right now, certain regulatory agencies, they've raised quotas again on bluefin, so the fight is still going. But it did show these efforts mattered. There was one very famous chef in France, Olivier Rongier, I think. I'm not necessarily pronouncing that right. But he went to a very large international consortium of chefs, and he convinced 500 chefs all around the world to sign a pledge that they would not serve bluefin. And that occurred just before this turnaround occurred. So there were many significant events that happened.
Your passion and the urgency of the issue comes through so loud and clear and has throughout the conversation, and I thank you for that. But is there something you wanted to touch upon or mention that I was remiss in not bringing up?
You know, I just think I'd like to reiterate that, you know, when I was in this kayak accident, there was a moment where I thought I had died, and a voice in my head asked me, do you want to live? And I said, yes. And that was the moment it turned around. And the one thing I just really want to communicate to people is that if you get to a place in your life, in any way, where you think you've passed the point of no return, where you can't see how things are turning around, don't quit. Listen for the yes. Listen for where the possibilities are. And I just say that from the bottom of my heart, because without that yes, I would not be here today.
That was Liz Cunningham, author of Ocean Country, One Woman's Voyage from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. You can find her at lizcunningham.net. Imagine WNBA star Maya Moore trying to sink a 20-foot jumper while wearing a full-length skirt. That would be really tough. Yet that's exactly how a team of Minneapolis girls played hoops last year. KFAI Sam Radwany tells how this is changing.
Inside the bright windowless gym at the Brian Coyle Center in Minneapolis, players from the Lady Warriors basketball team are playing one of their favorite warm-up games while the stench of bleach and sweat lingers in the air. 11-year-old Samira rolls to the bucket using her allotted 3 dribbles, but can't move very quickly because of the long dress she's wearing. For girls of East African descent like Samira and the rest of the Lady Warriors, it's important to uphold their culture and religion's traditional standards of modesty. But Samira says their clothes can get in the way of a fast break or a smooth jump shot.
Sometimes our scarves got off, and then we would have to pause the timeout because we need to fix it. And so our skirts were a problem because it was all the way down on our feet.
Her teammates agree.
Because when we're running and then our shoes get caught up in our dress and then it starts ripping.
And when you're wearing the scarves, it can just get on top of your head and you can't see anything.
Last season, some of the girls opted to wear long pants instead of dresses. But that still comes with its own set of problems.
Yeah, we always get sweaty and hot and our shirts stick to each other.
We have more layers than they do. They just wear like their jerseys and then we have to wear like our dress with it and our jersey.
And because the girls' team didn't have their own jerseys, they had to share with the boys.
It was like horrible, very horrible.
Sweaty. And the boys, their jerseys were all sweaty and yucky and nasty.
That's where the Minneapolis Girls Program stepped in. Thanks to a $120,000 grant, they formed a partnership between the University of Minnesota School of Design, the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport, and the local community. Jennifer Weber, the girls' coach, says experts from the university helped the players design the new uniforms.
So they got to make paper dolls with outfits, and then they got to look at prototypes. They knew what they wanted, and it was just getting it on paper, getting it into the design.
The final product aimed to solve a lot of the problems the players described. Chelsea Thule from the Tucker Center describes some of the features of the new uniforms.
And so this sport uniform has black leggings, and it's longer, probably about to the knees. Then it has long sleeves, and it's a breathable fabric.
The uniform also includes a special sports hijab. Again, Coach Jennifer Weber.
With the sports hijab, the biggest change to the hijab is that it's not a pullover, so that instead it fastens with Velcro. Like a yoga pants, it's got some give to it so that it's forgiving and it moves as they move.
And of course, with the young girls' input, there's a bit of color.
Like a lot of designs, like stripes or diamonds or stuff like that. So it could be like,
cute and cool.
Once the designs were finalized, seamsters and seamstresses from the community came together to hand-stitch the uniforms for the team, and it was time for their big night. The project culminated in a fashion show in an auditorium on campus this summer. The players strolled down the runway, modeling the various iterations of the new activewear. Nada says she had a blast, but the 11-year-old was still a bit jittery in front of the crowd.
At first, we thought that the fashion show would be fun, and so when we got backstage, my stomach started hurting. I had butterflies in my stomach.
Chelsea Thule said it was a very satisfying moment for everyone who worked on the project.
It's really hard to put into words, but they were just beaming from ear to ear.
For the young girls, the athletic wear was the first of its kind they'd ever owned. But it's not the only product out there. Thule says there are similar products available for adult women, like a modest swimsuit called the Burkini. Still, she says a young team of girls have never hit the court in matching uniforms like these.
Sometimes in sport, and historically we've seen this in sport, we kind of just go with the status quo, right? All I know is that there's a need. It's a huge gap.
And after all the publicity surrounding the fashion show, she found out exactly how much of a need there is. Thule says she's been getting calls from teams, coaches, and schools all over the country.
There you go.
Back in the Brian Coyle Center gym, the Lady Warriors are practicing their shooting, passing, and ball handling. Now, they can finally practice dribbling between the legs.
There it is, Sarah. Sarah's back. Good job.
For KFAI, this is Sam Radwany. 10,000 Fresh Voices is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1377.